It's time for Bigler's World. Ba-ba-ba-bum. That's going to make me Jim Bigler for the next hour or so. Reading kids' magazines of all kinds. This kind and that kind over there. Maybe a little National Geographic kids' magazine. Maybe a little science news for kids. Let's start with Dogo News. It's the Dogo News. Alaska's annual running of the reindeer race is one of a kind. You think? Leanne Humphreys wrote this article. It starts, ready, set, run. The reindeer are right behind you. The running of the reindeer race in Anchorage, Alaska, is a high-energy dash where thrill-seekers sprint through the streets with real reindeer chasing them. Inspired by Spain's running of the bulls, this annual event adds an Alaskan twist and is much safer. I don't know. They show they got some pretty big horns on them. The idea for the race emerged at Anchorage's Fur Rendezvous, as in Fur Rondi Festival, back in 2007. The reindeer broke free during a parade and raced through the city's downtown. Seeing the excitement, local radio host Bob Lester proposed making it an official event at the festival. The first race took place back in 2008. Excuse me. It included 9 reindeer charging alongside 1,000 participants through a 4-block stretch of downtown Anchorage. Over 10,000 spectators cheered as the runners tried to outpace the animals. Despite getting a head start, the humans were no match for the speedy reindeer. The running of the reindeer is now a major tourist attraction and even draws corporate sponsorships. To manage the crowds, runners are divided into 4 groups, each with its own herd of reindeer. This year's race, it was held on March 1st, of 2025, featured 1,500 runners trying to outpace 24 reindeer. As always, the outcome was never in doubt. Says Lester, the reindeer won. They always win. That's my DJ voice. The Fur Rondi Festival is held annually in Anchorage from February 20th to March 2nd. It began in 1935 to lift spirits during Alaska's long winter and celebrate the region's fur trade. At the time, Anchorage was a small town. February marked the arrival of trappers coming to sell their winter furs to add to the festivities. Organizers add social activities and contests. Over the years, it has grown into a major winter carnival. The event now features sled dog races, a snow sculpture competition, ice bowling, and, of course, the running of the reindeer. Next article here on Bigler's World. Sticking with Dogo News, Katy Perry to join Blue Origin's all-female flight to the edge of space. Marcella Bonnet wrote this particular article. Blue Origin's 11th human spaceflight, NS-31, will launch with an all-female crew on April 14th of 2025. This will be the first all-female crew mission since Soviet cosmonaut, see if you can pronounce this, Valentina Tereshkova, historic solo flight back in 1963. She was the first woman in space. Among the 6 passengers are American pop star Katy Perry, journalist Gail King, the former NASA aerospace engineer Aisha Bowie, Lauren Sanchez, a licensed pilot, and a partner of Blue Origin founder Jeff Bezos will lead the mission. The crew will depart from West Texas on Blue Origin's new Shepard rocket around 8:30 a.m., that's Central Time. Designed for suborbital space tourism, New Shepard's crew capsule features large windows to maximize the viewing experience. The vehicle operates autonomously, requiring no pilot. The spacecraft will ascend to an altitude of 62 miles, crossing the Kármán line. This is the internationally recognized boundary of space. The crew will unbuckle to experience about 4 minutes of weightlessness while taking in stunning views of the Earth. The rocket will then begin its descent to Earth. It will land vertically on a designated pad 2 miles north of the launch site. The entire flight from launch to landing will last approximately 8 minutes. Upon return, each crew member will receive a mission patch with customized symbols to commemorate the event. For instance, Perry's patch will feature a firework symbolizing her global influence on music and pop culture. King will showcase a microphone shaped like a shooting star. It represents her commitment to sharing important news stories with the world. The mission is part of Blue Origin's broader push to advance space tourism. The New Shepard program has already carried 52 people past the boundary of space. Previous notable passengers include Jeff Bezos, Star Trek actor William Shatner, and Laura Shepard Churchley. She's the daughter of Alan Shepard, the first American in space. Next article. Sticking with Dogo News once again for one more. Crafty cuttlefish are the masters of disguise and deception. Emily Moulin wrote this article. Cuttlefish are masters of disguise. These eight-armed cephalopods are known to rapidly change colors, patterns, and even texture of their skin to evade predators. Now researchers have discovered that these crafty mollusks also use this ability to catch prey. Matteo Santon of the University of Bristol in England and his team spent several months filming cuttlefish in Indonesia. They used live crabs as bait to attract local broad club cuttlefish and filmed their hunting behavior. The cuttlefish approached the crabs slowly. When they got to within 3 to 6 feet of their prey, they started changing their shape and color. The researchers identified 4 distinct hunting stages. The first was the leaf display, where the cuttlefish spread its sidearms and tucked the other ones into a cone. This also turned olive green and moved gently, mimicking a drifting leaf. That's how they got me. For the branching coral display, the cuttlefish raised 2 central arms and spread the others forward. It also turned orange and yellow. This was probably to blend in with the corals as it crept closer to its prey. In the passing stripe display, the mollusk darkened to gray except for a flashing black stripe running down its back. This added motion helped to hide its body as it moved toward the prey. The 4th strategy, called pulse, involved the cuttlefish pointing 2 arms forward and spreading its central arms wide. Dark pulses of color traveled along its body simultaneously. Scientists are unsure exactly how this disguise helps with hunting, but they speculate it may hide the cuttlefish's shape from its prey. The cuttlefish also showed the ability to switch between displays during a single hunt. For example, they might begin with the branching coral display and finish with a passing stripe and a shuffle ball change. They sometimes also combined 2 displays. They would take the shape of a leaf while sending pulses of dark color down their arms. Well, now I'm confused. The team's findings were published in the journal Ecology back on February 18th of 2025. The researchers are not sure how cuttlefish choose camouflage strategies for different hunting scenarios, but their study reveals just how adaptable and intelligent these creatures are. Though called cuttlefish, these creatures are not fish at all. They are a type of mollusk and part of the cephalopod family, closely related to octopuses and squid. Scientists have identified over 100 species of cuttlefish worldwide. They all have remarkable camouflage abilities. Cuttlefish are also skilled hunters. They use their specialized tentacles to capture prey with lightning-fast precision. Okay, next up on Bigler's World. Let's go to another publication here. I got a little science news. Science News Explores. It's entitled Mosquitoes Taste You Before They Decide to Bite. Understanding what they like and hate could lead to better ways to limit those bites, says Katie Cottingham, who wrote this article. At a summer barbecue, mosquitoes feast on some of the guests, while luckier partiers stay free, bite-free. This research explains why some people just taste better. Who is this? Lisa Bayek. She's a sensory biologist at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. She says it feels personal sometimes, like they are biting me. She studies how insects, especially mosquitoes, sense their world. Mosquitoes like certain ingredients in sweat, Bikes team now finds. The insects showed clear favorites, biting some sweet samples more than others.
She says, we've known that mosquitoes love us and that they're able to find us very effectively and land on our skin, but we didn't know what happens after that. Mosquitoes bite people and other animals to get a blood meal, but these insects are sloppy eaters. They leave behind saliva in their target's skin. That spit can carry harmful microbes that cause diseases like malaria, dengue fever, and yellow fever. Such diseases can make people very ill and even kill. Knowing what causes mosquitoes to bite or not can help researchers create better ways to stop them. The team shared its new insights last November in Nature. Sweating it out. One clue is that mosquitoes are able to taste the surfaces on which they land, Bike's team finds. In fact, sweat may play a big role in whether they bite. Human sweat contains water, salt, and amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. To see what mosquitoes prefer, the researchers put salt and amino acids on separate surfaces. Mosquitoes ignored the salt. They also didn't go for the amino acids. But when the team combined both on the same surface, the mosquitoes bit. In another experiment, researchers coated one side of a surface with sweat samples from several volunteers. Mosquitoes bit sweat from two of those people much more than from others. The researchers then looked at activity in certain mosquito nerve cells involved in taste. The more appealing sweat had a bigger effect on the activity of those nerves than the other sweat samples had. That suggests that, says Bike, could be one of the factors as to why some of us get bitten a lot more than others. This was quite exciting. A taste for sugar. Bike wanted to explore how taste might drive mosquitoes' choice to bite or not. Tasting requires touch. We use our lips, mouth, and tongue to taste. Mosquitoes do too. A long tube extends from their face like a giant straw. At the end of that proboscis are two small lip-like parts that can touch a surface. They're called labella. The researchers examined these labella using a special microscope. The lips had little hairs on them. Nerve cells inside the hairs respond to touch. Then the team tested how the hairs responded to different flavor molecules. When sugars touched the hairs, they activated the nerve cells. Some bitter compounds, though, blocked the nerve cells' response to sugar. Says Bike, this was exciting and surprising. This type of activity blocking, she notes, hasn't been seen in other insects. Adding such bitter substances to sugar reduced the nerve's response to sweet. It also made the mosquitoes less likely to feed. This suggested that we could use bitter compounds as a way to stop the feeding behavior of mosquitoes, says Bike. Let's see, who is this? Ben Matthews works at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And he says, this team was really the first to systematically show what the taste cells in this mosquito actually respond to. Though Ben Matthews did not take part in the new work, Matthews studies insect sensory systems. The new work showed not just how these chemicals are processed, but how that affects behavior. Bike is now hunting for just the right compound to stop mosquitoes from biting people. The substance should be low-cost, safe, and eco-friendly. It could someday be included in a spray for skin and clothing. And better mosquito protection is more urgent than ever, Bike adds. Climate change is expanding the range of certain mosquitoes and the diseases they spread at an alarming rate. Methods to prevent mosquito bites could protect people worldwide. Next article here. On Bigler's World, sticking with science news explorers. Science. Okay, I had to read this one. I'm sorry. Earth farts may explain some spooky floating lights and a lot of other things. Ignition of gases emitted by earthquakes may be behind some eerie events in South Carolina. Is that what it was? Nick Ogasa wrote this article. Ghostly lights in South Carolina might trace to earthquake activity, new research suggests. Since the 50s, people have reported strange balls of light floating down a road along old railroad tracks near Somerville, South Carolina. These spooky shimmers are known as the Somerville light. Local lore says a grieving ghost's lantern is behind the glow. Geologist Susan Howe now proposes a different explanation. Howe works for the U.S. Geological Survey in Pasadena, California. Quakes can release gases, including radon and methane. These vapors could ignite from static electricity or sparks from passing trains, she suggests. Interestingly, Somerville sits far from any tectonic plate boundaries. As such, it might seem an unlikely spot for quakes. But in 1886, damage from a magnitude 7 quake killed 60 people in nearby Charleston. Hundreds of aftershocks shook the region in the decades that followed. That points to the area's continuing high seismic activity. The region has plenty of ghost tales, too. The legend of Somerville Light may be the most gruesome. A railroad worker's wife was supposedly waiting for him by the tracks one night. Then she got word that he had been beheaded in an accident. Since then, the legend goes, she's returned with a lantern, even after her death, in search of her husband's head. I don't know why that's funny, but, you know, it was back in 1886. Digging into records and earthquake history, Howe scouted for a less spooky explanation of the phenomenon. To begin, she dug into books, magazines, and online sources. She was looking for recorded sightings of the mysterious lights. Then she studied the area's earthquake history from 1890 to 1960. This included long before the sightings began. Only a few quakes had been reported over that time. There was a magnitude 3.9 quake in 1907. Another magnitude 4.4 event shook the area in 1959, around when the sightings began. A couple of smaller quakes followed shortly thereafter in 1960. They likely would have been smaller, undetected tremors, Howe says. And it's possible that these jolts might have caused the lights. Howe also hunted other local paranormal claims. She found reports of cars shaking and the moving of objects and doors. Some people even heard footsteps in upstairs rooms. Subtle quakes might explain all of these, she says. Howe published her findings in March issue of Seismological Research Letters. Get yours today. Many of the reports Howe turned up seemed to fit with shaking that would have rated 2 on the modified Mercalli intensity, or the MMI scale. Scientists use the scale to rate quakes based on the damage they cause. An MMI of 2 is fairly weak. It would likely be, says Howe, felt only by a few persons at rest, especially on the upper floors of the building. Her proposal that the lights and other strange activity trace to quakes is reasonable, says Yuji Enomoto. He's an earthquake scientist at Shinshu University in Matsumoto, Japan. Still, he says, more geological data are needed to confirm quakes as triggers for the Somerville Light. He'd like data, for instance, on the presence of an oxygen-free environment containing organic or carbon-based matter. This could be capable of generating methane, he notes, which can support a flame. Also helpful, he adds, would be a finding of granite-based bedrock containing radium, which can produce radon. Ghost stories elsewhere might also be due to subtle seismic activity, notes Howe. There's a bunch of ghosts wandering the rails in different places in the United States, she says. They, too, may be illuminating shallow active faults. Okay, let's do one more article from Science News Explorers. This is an odd title. Could trees ever get up and walk away? Okay. During a rock concert, maybe. Trees might not march like they do in the movies, but they can move, says Sophie Hartley. In the second The Lord of the Rings movie, The Two Towers, an army of tree-like creatures called Ents, E-N-T-S, slowly marches to war. They walk for miles through thick, dark forests. Once they arrive at Saruman's fortress, the Ents unleash destruction, as only trees can. They hurl giant boulders, climb over walls, and even rip open a dam to wipe out their enemy. For trees, the Ents are quite athletic. Such active trees can be found throughout science fiction and fantasy worlds. The tree-like alien Groot from the Guardians of the Galaxy uses twiggy wings to fly through the skies. Trees called Evermeans will walk toward and fight the main character Link in the Legend of Zelda video games. And Harry Potter's Whomping Willow, well, it whomps anyone who gets too close. It can be hard to find the similarities between agile fiction trees and the seemingly still forests we see in real life, but science has shown us that trees and forests do move. They're just really, really slow. Searching for light. All trees move as their seeds grow into saplings, stretching up towards the sun. Saplings need sunlight and water to develop, but when they sprout in a place where the sun is blocked by shade, they have to work for those nutrients. Who is this? Gerardo Avalos. He's a plant psychologist. He's a physiologist at the University of Costa Rica. He says, a tree needs to find enough food, in this case, solar energy. By slowly stretching their branches in a sunny direction, trees can orient themselves to get the most food possible. This light-chasing phenomenon is called phototropism. Let's see here. The article continues. While trees can stretch and move their appendages, it's very different from how humans and ants move. No one comes up and whispers to a tree about where it can find water and sunlight. Instead, a tree's hormones send messages to encourage growth when the tree needs more light or water. Tree roots move, too. When they sense moisture in surrounding soil, trees will push their roots towards the likely source of the water. While searching for water underground, roots have found wells, plumbing, and pipes. Says Avalos, sometimes they get into people's toilets. One minute, it flushes like it should, and then all of a sudden there is something wrong with the toilet. What is wrong? I don't know. In addition to destroying people's bathrooms, funky-looking roots have also inspired folklore. Some scientists and tour guides tell of a walking tree in the tropical forest of South and Central America. This walking palm tree can supposedly travel up to 20 meters or 70 feet a year. The palm roots that grow above the ground and look similar to octopus tentacles, some people have hypothesized that the tree uses these roots to search for light across the shady forest floor. Images of walking palms seemingly sliding down steep hills have inspired some of the folklore, explains Avalos. He says, they say that the palm was walking, crossing creeks, going up and down slopes. But according to Avalos, the notion of a tree getting up and walking in real life is pretty ridiculous. There's no concrete scientific evidence that this happens. Forests on the move. While individual trees can't cross rivers and climb mountains, entire forests can, and climate change is making their journeys treacherous. Forests don't migrate like monarch butterflies, which fly back and forth in tempo with the changing seasons. Instead, forests migrate to compensate for long-term changes in their habitats. Who is this? Leslie Brandt, an ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service in St. Paul, Minnesota, says, trees have been migrating forever. During the last ice age, when the Laurentide ice sheet, there it is, covered most of Canada and the northern United States, many tree species took refuge in warmer southern climates. They didn't walk or fly there. Instead, forests moved over the course of many generations through spreading seeds and new tree growth. Says Brandt, there are seeds like acorns that squirrels will pick up and move around. Think of Scrat digging his prize acorn to the ends of the earth in Ice Age. Maple tree seeds are encased in tiny helicopters that help them soar with the wind. Berries contain seeds that birds eat and poop out. These features can spread seeds out in all directions, but seeds don't have equally good chances of growing in all places. As northern habitats got colder during ice ages, for instance, it was likely easier for seeds to thrive toward the warmer south. As a result, more new trees started growing on the southern edges of forests, while older trees up north died out. Slowly, forests migrated, moving around 100 to 500 meters a year, Brandt says. But now human-caused climate change is changing habitats faster than forests are prepared to move. Mangrove forests, which grow on seacoasts, are under threat from rising oceans. Warmer temperatures in Canada are making it difficult for white spruce to grow. And pinyon pines are struggling with drier climates in the American Southwest, says Brandt. Trees just cannot keep up. Their habitats are changing faster than they can migrate, so humans are helping them out by moving them. To give forests a leg up, some scientists are planting new seeds in areas with favorable conditions. This is called assisted migration. Sometimes assisted migration can even mean replacing species that are no longer equipped to handle a changed landscape with species better suited to new conditions. In Minnesota, Brandt is studying trees on the banks of the Mississippi River. The area is flooding more frequently and severely, and invasive beetles are destroying the forests. Floodplain trees like silver maples are dying and struggling to grow.
We're looking to replace the trees that are lost with those that are better adapted to the current climate, says Brandt.
Planting trees that would thrive near water, like cottonwoods and willows, could be part of the solution. Nearby, the Superior National Forest just created an assisted migration plan, a guidebook to help forest managers prepare for climate change. Because trees can hold cultural significance, the team has been working with scientists, Minnesota residents, and local indigenous tribes to make sure the forest migration plan aligns with community needs. Even though forests need to adapt in order to survive climate change,
we don't want to completely change the forest, Brandt says, because people rely on those trees.
Okay, let's head over to Time for Kids. That's right, it's Time Magazine for Kids. The Magic of Nature is this article. TFK kid reporter Dylan Landau wrote this. What is this? Oh, it's a book report or book interview. TFK kid reporter Dylan Landau read Magic Nature Tales and interviewed its author, Don Casey. And it commands me to read Dylan's thoughts below. I wish I could. I'll just read the article. Magical Nature Tales by Don Casey is a wonderful collection of folk tales from around the world. True to the book's title, each story features a touch of magic, talking animals, enchanted trees, I'm thinking ones that can move, mystical beings. Anja Sun Sanj, beautiful illustrations, add to the story's magic. Many of the tales in the book are very old. Is this Casey talking to Time for Kids? Yes, it is.
For me, the old stories have a particular value because they've come through so many generations of people,
Casey told Time for Kids.
People have specifically chosen those stories and kept them alive because they knew there was something valuable in them, some wisdom or some magic that they wanted to pass on.
Casey wanted to write this book because she loves nature. As a child, she lived in London. Oh, I should have been doing the London accent then. Though it is big city, she managed to connect with nature in small ways. She'd eat blackberries growing on a forgotten fence or pick dandelions and make a wish before blowing their seeds. Casey believes we're all deeply connected to nature.
I really believe and feel in my bones that we are all nature. She says, nature is not something separate from us. We're all part of one huge web of life.
And see, the author of this article says, I would highly recommend Magical Nature Tales to anyone who likes folk tales or feels a special connection with nature. Next article. Sticking with Time for Kids. Book Support is the name of this article by Jamie Joyce. On a sunny Saturday morning in late February, Rohan, if I can pronounce this, Mukhopadhyay, he unpacked 10 boxes of brand new children's books. He was at the Beehive, a venue in Los Angeles, California, with his mom, dad, and brother. Together, they arranged the books on folding tables. All were gifts from donors, including authors and publishers. Rohan, 13 years old, was giving them away as a part of a program he started calling Reading Among Ruins. Let's see, they got a picture of him getting ready at his temporary home in Santa Monica. Rohan organizes books for a donation in his bare feet, by the way. He's sitting there in his bare feet, arranging books. Article continues. Just weeks earlier, wildfires had torn through Los Angeles, destroying more than 16,000 structures, including schools and houses. Rohan and his family lost their home in the Palisades fire, and with it, Rohan lost his beloved book collection. And he says, "I was heartbroken," talking to Time for Kids. "It made me wonder how other people, other kids, felt about losing their books." That simple question kick-started Rohan's relief effort. "I wanted to help," he says. Now the seventh grader is going all out to get books to young people who were affected by the fires. Books matter. In its first month, Reading Among Ruins gave away more than 1,000 books to kids. Asher Finkelthal, 13 years old, was one, and he says, "I like the feeling of books," Asher told Time for Kids, "and I like rereading books." Losing his books was devastating. Rohan's giveaway lifted Asher's spirits. Using an online form, says, Asher again, "I requested a few books by Stuart Gibbs. He's one of my favorite authors." Soon, Rohan gifted him with books from Gibbs' Fun Jungle and Spy School series. "It felt really good to receive them," Asher says. "It's nice to know that other people care about books also and want to help people rebuild their collections." Verena Mara, 10 years old, also got books from Rohan. He learned a powerful lesson. "If you are in a tough situation," Vereen says, "people will be there for you." Books are there for people, too. It's Comfort Joy. Zibby Owens is founder of Zibby's Bookshop in Santa Monica. She says, "There's things that you come back to again and again." Yes, I said it. Rohan and his family are frequent visitors at Zibby's. Owens is also leading a campaign to rebuild school libraries. "I think that's what he's doing is amazing," she says about Rohan. "Being able to sense what your friends need in time of distress, that is a superpower." Community spirit. Officials say it will take time to recover from the wildfires. Until then, the community has come together to support neighbors in need. The giveaway Rohan did in February was part of a larger effort called Together We Rebuild. Local groups provide essential items like clothing and furniture. They also connect with people with financial aid and help them find housing. Kids got special attention at the day-long event. There was entertainment and a petting zoo, and there was lots of free toys and books, says Rohan's mom, Pooja Chungani. She says, "We probably gave away more than a couple of hundred books. Actually, we lost track." I get a picture of Rohan remembering how kids looked as they made their selections. "Really excited," he says. As long as there's a need, he plans to keep on giving. Okay, let's go to another magazine completely here on Bigler's World. On Sounds of Arizona. Sure. What do we got here? Scout Life. It's not Boys Life anymore. Sorry. It's Scout Life. Ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Ride on a Boat Underground is the title here. Michael Freeman wrote this particular article. It says right here, this troop explored a cavern that's home to the largest underground lake in North America. Peering deep into the deep, milky blue water, scouts spotted something they didn't expect to see, rainbow trout. You wouldn't think it would be all that surprising to notice fish in a lake. However, this lake is 140 feet below ground. Last May, Troop 11 of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, spent a weekend exploring the Lost Sea, a 4.5-acre lake within the Craighead Caverns in eastern Tennessee. Not only did the guys ride a tour bus across the underground lake, but they also crawled through muddy passages, and they spent a night in the cave. Eagle Scout Scott Cameron Thompson says, "You really can't improve on this too much. It was a great outing." Sea tales. Water is below your feet practically everywhere on Earth. It's what we often tap into to get water for drinking or irrigating crops. What's rare about the Lost Sea is that the groundwater doesn't usually pool together in such a large area. The lake is so big, experts aren't exactly sure where it ends.
It is the second largest underground lake in the world, only behind the Dragon's Breath Cave in the African country of Namibia, which measures slightly bigger at almost 5 acres. Troop 11 wanted to check out these natural cave marvels there, so I'm paraphrasing because I completely blew that. So they booked an overnight experience at the Tennessee Caverns. It was the first time some of the guys had been spelunking or caving. When they arrived, the scouts first learned about the history of the Craighead Caverns. They were once used as a meeting place for Cherokee tribes. During the Civil War, Confederate soldiers mined it for saltpeter, a material needed to make gunpowder. Asa Beckett, 11 years old, scout, says, "We learned what it was like down in a cave. There were burn marks written by soldiers on the cave walls." In 1905, a 13-year-old boy discovered the Lost Sea. Over the years, the caverns were developed into an adventurous destination with boats, walking paths, and tours of undeveloped parts of the cave. Totally cool. The article continues on one of these pages I'm trying to get out here. Getting dirty. After carrying their gear to where they would sleep for the night, the guys loaded onto a metal flat-bottom boat for a brief trip on the water. They watched the rainbow trout swim around the 70-foot-deep lake. The fish were introduced to the Lost Seas decades ago in hopes that they would show the previous owner if there was a passage out of the cave. Instead, the fish stayed. 17-year-old Eagle Scout Leland Graham says, "They try to nibble at anything that touches the water." Then it was on to a main tour of the caverns before the guys turned on their headlamps for the Wild Cave Tour. This guided, 2-hour excursion called on them to straddle rocks, slide down clay-covered floors, and crawl through narrow passages. Will Tart, he's 12 years old, a first-class scout, says,
"I felt kind of scared about the crawls, but when I realized that they weren't as tight as I thought they were, I had totally green pants after spelunking. They were clay orange."
Having their headlamps, taped to their helmets helped make sure the guys had light where they needed it. So this 14-year-old star scout, Ethan Cantella, says, "Once your fingers were covered with mud, it was hard to press the headlamp's buttons because it was so slippery." It's important to see where to go, but the light brightened fascinating cave formations as well, like anthodites, also known as cave flowers. These intricate straw-like structures take thousands of years just to grow an inch. In the dark, the scouts cleaned up, bagged their muddy clothes, and got ready for bed inside a cave. But first, they played a fun card game called Taco Cat Goat Cheese Pizza. When it was time for lights out, the guys' senses heightened, and it was tough going to sleep for many of them. Leland says, "Once all the noise goes away, it's eerily silent. Your ears aren't picking up any audio. There's no sound of anything." After a while, the adults started snoring. Cameron says, "I think I was one of the lucky few that fell asleep before the assistant scoutmaster started snoring. It wasn't the best night of sleep I've ever had because it was on a rock surface, but it wasn't too bad. Lying on a rock isn't comfy, but temperature inside the cave felt nice at 58 degrees. The climate in the cave doesn't change as dramatically as it does at the surface," says Asa.
"We had sleeping bags that could withstand 30-degree weather. I slept with a sweatshirt and a beanie, so I was fine."
Super spelunking. The troop emerged in the morning, greeted by the warmth of the sun. Will says, "The most rewarding part was seeing the sun after 12 hours in the cave." After a game of Frisbee in the parking lot, the guys loaded up for the long ride back home. It was a fun trip. The scouts learned a lot about caves, history, and themselves. And let's see, who is this? Ethan says, "I learned that I do like the crawls. I'm not claustrophobic. I want to go caving some more." Will Tart grabs his gear before entering the cave. Helmets are a must-have for spelunking. And it's got a list of safety equipment that you need in case you want to. I don't know whether I got this article or not. Let's see here. America's Cave Safety Cave Softly Guide. If I read that one, I'm not sure. Next article here. Sticking with Scout Life. True stories of scout in action. For some reason, I couldn't get that out. These are, true stories of scout in action. Let's see here. Pum, 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 pum. This is the music for pum, 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 pum. Their canoe capsized. Pum, pum. Jacob Baker, 17 years old, was canoeing with his dad and brother on Yellow Breeches Creek in Pennsylvania when the powerful current swept them into a pile of logs that had fallen across the water. A canoe pinned the Bakers against the debris. Jacob and his brother could barely keep their heads above the surface. Seeing that his brother was about to go under, Jacob grabbed his brother's life jacket to hold him up. This gave Jacob's dad time to get in position to help the boys. Jacob's foot became lodged in the debris, making it even more difficult for him to keep his head above the water. Still, Jacob told his dad to save his brother first. Mr. Baker pulled Jacob's brother out, then helped Jacob get out as well. The Bakers were still trapped on the creek, in danger of hypothermia. Jacob crawled across a fallen tree trunk and swam downstream, where he waited to catch his dad or brother, in case the current swept them away. Jacob's dad and brother made it to the shore, and the three of them hiked to the nearest road and called Jacob's mom to pick them up. No one was seriously hurt during the ordeal. It says right here, Life Scout Jacob D. Baker, a member of Troop 190, chartered to Kiwanis Club of Upper Allen, Inc., in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, received a heroism award for his actions. It says down at the bottom here, Scouts in Action subjects come from the National Court of Honor. If you know of an act of heroism that should be recognized, contact your local council office for a life-saving or meritorious award application. It says, note, consult approved safety guidelines, as actions depicted here may not precisely follow standard procedures. They got more true stories of Scouts in Action, which I'm going to read because it's right here. He saved his sister after a fall. Bum, 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 bum. Dustin Deacon, 16 years old, was playing with his family in and around a river near Camas, Utah, when his sister slipped and was swept down a 40-foot waterfall. That's a big one. She was lying motionless at the base of the falls. Dustin climbed down a rocky cliff, entered the rushing water, and pulled his sister to safety. He kept her head above the water and waited for his family to help him get her back to shore. Dustin's sister was awake but in tremendous pain. An onlooker called 911. Dustin asked people for blankets and extra clothing to prevent hypothermia. He talked to his sister to keep her calm. She suffered multiple broken bones, but later recovered. Eagle Scout Dustin Graham Deacon, a member of Troop 126 chartered to Fowler, Inc. in Tremont, Utah, received a heroism award for his actions. And they got another one here. He saved a runner. Bum, 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 bum. Graham Sign, 16 years old. He was volunteering with other scouts at a late-night charity run in Palo Alto, California, when a runner told Graham someone had collapsed on the trail. After locating the man, checking his pulse, and finding that he was breathing, Graham told another scout to call 911. When Graham checked the man's pulse again, he found that he had stopped breathing, so Graham began CPR. A police officer arrived and took over from Graham. Paramedics arrived and finally revived the runner and took him to a hospital. The man later recovered. Life Scout Graham Sign, a member of Troop 57, chartered to the parents of Troops 57 and 4057 of Palo Alto, California, received a Medal of Merit for his actions. It's a Medal of Merit. Next article here, sticking with Scouts. Scouting life, scout life. Let's see, what do we got here? Does this have a title to it? It says features. Michael Freeman wrote this. I don't know what the heck it is. These scouts found challenges to conquer close to home. I don't see a title to this article. I don't know why. Walking along a slack line doesn't look that hard. No. You're basically balancing in a tightly strung nylon strap only a foot off the ground, and the strap seems wide enough that you could easily place your feet on it. But once you get on the slack line, you realize it's quite a challenge to stay sure-footed. The scouts of Troop 911 of St. Charles, Missouri, had each other to lean on as they tried these slack lines and several other obstacles at a local county park. See, who is this? Life Scout Eva Best, 13 years old, says,
everyone got to know each other better. We could learn each other's weaknesses and strengths, and we could play off of those. We learned to trust each other more. Work like a team. Missouri Bluffs Park, also in St. Charles, features a group camping site and a low ropes course. The course has 10 stations, each with a physical challenge, like balance beams, tire swings, and a wooden climbing wall. Everything was close to the ground, but to stay safe, the scouts wore helmets and asked park officials to guide them through each obstacle. They also served as spotters to make sure their fellow scouts didn't fall. Getting through an obstacle required not only strength and balance, but also strategy and teamwork, says Brooke Mushler, 12 years old, a second-class scout.
It was fun to see how far we could get. Some tactics really worked for some, but for others, it was just impossible. We had to use a little bit of trial and error.
Working together helped them get through each obstacle. The tougher the challenge, the more enjoyable it was to overcome. Says Holly Mushler, 12 years old. Wait a minute, was there another Mushler? Brooke. Must be Holly's sister. Maybe they're twins because they're both 12 years old. She says, with teamwork, we could get through anything. On the trail. The park also connects to Caddy. I'm going to say Caddy Trail. Is that Caddy Trail? Which runs 240 miles across most of Missouri. It used to be a railroad line, but now people use it for hiking, horseback riding, or bicycling. Troop 911 cycled about 7 miles on the trail before heading back to camp, totaling nearly 15 miles. Before they did, they reviewed cycling safety, says Star Scout Kyra Landers, 15 years old.
We went over hand signals and what they meant so we could safely ride together and ride around other people.
Even on the relatively short stretch of the trail, there was plenty to see. The girls spotted chipmunks and a snake. Before you know it, there was only the snake. They also pedaled over a truss bridge and checked out the Missouri River. The troop didn't have to go far from home to create memories. You, too, can find cool places nearby where you can try something new and have a lot of fun. After the camp out, the scouts felt that they have bonded, especially many who were new to the troop. Natalie Williams, 15 years old, the Life Scout, says,
at our meetings, people are enjoying it a lot more. They can go and see their friends, not just people they do scouting with.
Next article here. Got a lot of articles in Scout Life. Scout Life. Don't Bug Me is the name of this article by Jose Santos. Be prepared for biting and stinging insects. I will. Be prepared. Are you ready to deal with biting and stinging bugs you might encounter on a hike, at camp, or just when you're outside? Here's info about some of them, including how to avoid them. Ticks and chiggers. I don't know why I'm laughing. What are they? Well, ticks aren't technically insects. They are arachnids like spiders. They feed on blood, usually over hours to days. No matter what you've heard, ticks don't fly or drop from trees onto you. Most sit patiently on a plant, waiting for the next meal to walk close enough to latch onto. Chiggers are mites that are closely related to ticks. Here's what to do. Some ticks can cause serious disease, like Rocky Mountain spotted fever or Lyme disease. Walk in the middle of the trails, since ticks are more likely to be in the dense vegetation alongside them. Tuck your pants into your socks and frequently check yourself for ticks. If you find one, don't twist, jerk, burn, or smother it. Instead, grab it with tweezers as close to its head as possible and steadily pull out. Wash the bite area with soap and water, and then apply antibiotic cream and an ice pack. Seek medical help if you become ill. As with mosquitoes, certain repellents are effective in keeping ticks away. Repellents can also be effective with chiggers. They tend to bite in areas where clothing is tight against the skin. These very small bugs are usually long gone by the time you start itching. Mosquitoes, what are they?
These insects are a type of blood-feeding fly. Although it's not well understood why certain people get bitten more than others, it likely has to do with factors like diet, genetics, and chemicals in your body that it naturally releases. What to do? Not only do their bites itch, but some mosquitoes can also spread diseases like West Nile and Zika. Is that Zika virus? Mosquitoes need standing water to complete their life cycle. If you've ever seen worm-like creatures wiggling around in a bird bath or bucket of water, they were likely immature mosquitoes. Dumping the water is the best way to fight mosquitoes. To protect yourself from bites, wear pants and long sleeves and use a repellent containing DEET at 20-30% concentration, or picaridin, I guess that's how you pronounce it, 20% concentration. Treat your clothing with that. Okay, they got centipedes and millipedes. What are they? Centipedes and millipedes are related to insects and arachnids. You can easily tell centipedes which might bite from millipedes which won't by their legs. Centipedes have one pair slash segment, and millipedes have two pairs slash segments. Millipedes don't sting, but the first pair of legs on a centipede can inject venom, causing a painful sting. What to do? Although their venom is not considered very dangerous, it's best not to touch centipedes. If you're camping in an area with them, keep your tent closed, shake out your boots, and use your flashlight at night. If you are stung, clean the bite with soap and water and then apply antibiotic cream and an ice pack. See medical attention if you have an allergic reaction. And they got a bunch of things here. Wasps, bees, hornets, yellow jackets. What are they? Well, most flying insects that sting live in nests that can be hidden in a log, in a bush, underground, or even high in a tree. They tend to be very defensive of their nests and are willing to sting to protect their homes. What to do? Well, the stings can really hurt, and they can also pose a significant threat to people who are allergic. It is important that you recognize their nests or signs of a nest. For example, yellow jackets flying out of a hole, and steer clear. Wasps, yellow jackets, and hornets have a smooth, barbless stinger that doesn't get stuck and pull off, which allows them to sting multiple times. Honeybees do leave stingers behind, so scrape out the stinger with the edge of a knife blade or credit card. It says never squeeze the stinger out. With all stings, clean the area with soap and water, apply antibiotic cream and an ice pack. If you're allergic, get medical help immediately. Then there's spiders. What are they? Well, technically, almost all spiders are venomous, but the vast majority of these arachnids in the U.S. don't usually pose a serious threat. Tarantulas are found primarily in the Southwest, and their bite can be painful. Black widows are often found under rocks and stumps and are easily identified by their shiny black color and a red hourglass on their underside. See, their venom attacks the nervous system, causing pain and muscle spasms. The brown recluse, or fiddleback spider, mainly in the South and Midwest, has a fiddle or violin shape on its back and is brown with long legs. Outside, they're usually under bark and in rock piles. Their venom breaks down cells, often causing large wounds requiring medical care. Yikes. What to do? Run. Wear gloves when working in places like wood piles where spiders might be. Avoid putting your hands in dark places where you cannot see. When camping, shake out boots and clothing before putting them on. If you are bitten, wash the area with warm soapy water and apply antibiotic cream and a cold compress. That just fits everything here. If the bite is from a black widow or brown recluse, or you experience an allergic reaction or severe symptoms to any bite, get medical help immediately. And they got a thing at the bottom here about the author. Dr. Portugal is an assistant extension professor of urban entomology at Mississippi State University and a former scout. He and his son Cameron are part of Cub Scout Pack 45 in Starkville, Mississippi. Okay, I think we got time for one more article. Let's go to another publication, shall we? Do a little National Geographic Kids magazine. Kind of got a thing on Iraq. I don't know that much about Iraq, even though we invaded them several years ago. Iraq, it says here, is dominated by two famous rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates.
I seem to remember that one. They got Fast Facts. Fast Facts, official name, the Republic of Iraq. Form of government, parliamentary democracy. The capital is in Baghdad. The population is 40,194,216. Doesn't say how long ago that was. Official languages, Arabic and Kurdish. Their money is the new Iraq dinar, not the old one. How big is it? It is 168,754 square miles. Once again, it's got major rivers as Tigris and Euphrates. Here's some geography. Iraq is dominated by two famous rivers. We already went through that. They flow southeast from the highlands in the north across the plains towards the Persian Gulf. The fertile region between these rivers has many names throughout history, including Al-Jazira, or the island, in Arabic, and Mesopotamia in Greek. Many parts of Iraq are harsh places to live. Rocky deserts cover about 40% of the land. Another 30% is mountainous with bitterly cold winters. Much of the south is marshy and damp. Most Iraqis live along the fertile plains of the Tigris and Euphrates. People and culture. Iraq is one of the most culturally diverse nations in the Middle East. Arabs, Kurds, Turkmen, Assyrians, Mandeans, and Armenians, among others, speak their own languages and retain their culture and religious identities. Iraq once had one of the best schools and colleges in the Arab world. That changed after the Gulf War in 1991 and the United Nations sanctions that followed. Today, only about 40% of Iraqis can read or write. Nature. Safeguarding Iraq's wildlife is a big job. There are essentially no protected natural areas in the country. And with an ongoing war, the government is, understandably, more concerned with protecting people and property than plants and animals. Before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, several species were considered at risk, including cheetahs, wild goats, dugongs. Scientists have not been able to assess the conditions of these animals since the war started. Iraq's rivers and marshes are home to many fish, including carp that can grow up to 300 pounds, and sharks that swim up from the Persian Gulf. History. Iraq is nicknamed the Cradle of Civilization. Thousands of years ago, on the plains that make up about a third of Iraq, powerful empires rose and fell. While people in Europe and the Americas were still hunting and gathering and living more primitive lives. They got the Sumerians. They had the first civilization in Iraq around 3000 BC. Babylonian rule ended in 539 BC when the Persians took over. In AD 646, Arabs overthrew the Persians and introduced Islam to Iraq. Baghdad was soon established as the leading city of the Islamic world. In 1534, the Ottomans from Turkey conquered Iraq and ruled until the British took over almost 400 years later. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.